Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope you're having a safe and relaxing Memorial Day. This hour, we're revisiting one of our favorite programs from this past year, including a conversation about the best foods in the Midwest, whether we're talking Chicago hot dogs, St. Louis ribs, or sweet corn. But first, many college students graduated in these past couple of weeks, and this fall, a new crop of incoming first-year students will, in many cases, be leaving home for the first time. This transition sometimes can be a difficult one, and we've actually seen the number of college students who are seeking help for serious mental health problems steadily increasing over the past 3 decades. That's according to the American Psychological Association. What can be done to stem this trend? A study published in the Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry finds that student peer-run mental health clubs across 12 California colleges helped increase awareness of mental health issues and to reduce stigma. Active Minds is one peer-run mental health group. They have more than 450 chapters across the country in high school and colleges, which focus on peer education and support for mental health. Joining us now, Devin Dion is vice president of the U of I chapter of Active Minds. Dave DeBoer is a psychologist and director of the Counseling Wellness Center at Loyola University in Chicago. I spoke with both of them back in August, and I started by asking David about the most common mental health challenges he sees at Loyola.
Well, we're seeing at Loyola what most of our colleagues and counterparts across the country are seeing, which is high levels of stress overall. Anxiety and depression are really the top two mental health issues that are impacting students academically. And students have a hard time, maintaining healthy sleep and just general physical health when they're in the throes of the stresses of the semester.
Devin, as a student at the University of Illinois, I wonder, as you're hearing this discussion about stress, what other things you find that are tough for students to deal with on a day-to-day basis?
You know, I think the stress is certainly, a real highlight of the issue here. But what I see, and this especially happened to me a little bit, was, college students, you mentioned it before, college students, this is a completely new experience for everybody. And here at the University of Illinois, we have a very diverse population of people, especially, international students who may come here, they don't have any connections. I know I didn't know a lot of people coming into college, and so oftentimes students will just feel it's this loneliness, and that leads to the feelings of anxiety and stress and depression. And on top of that, you have all your schoolwork. Some of the coursework here at the University of Illinois is pretty rigorous, and students often find themselves, seldom sleeping, more than 5 hours a day. And it's just, there's overall this culture on campus where it's kind of accepted, to have poor mental health. And that's something that we hope to change within the near future.
Now, Devin, you're a sophomore, right?
Yes, correct.
I wonder, do you feel like now that you have had a year of university, of being at the U of I, do you think that makes your second year easier because you know what you're facing? I wonder what you see with your peer groups. Do you see more freshmen than upperclassmen, or is it a pretty even mix across the board?
Yeah, so I think I'm starting to see a lot more freshmen. I was in this class. It was like a business 101 class, and majority of them were freshmen. There are a lot of freshmen. I know across the country, many more freshmen are being admitted into college just because it's becoming more, it's becoming more of a popular thing now. And I think that I definitely see a lot more newer students on campus.
And we've heard that it can be pretty difficult to get an appointment at the counseling center at the U of I. Yes, you think that's true?
Because you have to, the lines open, for you to call at, I think, 7:50 in the morning. And I don't know too many people who are up at 7:50 in the morning in college. And so the lines are practically filled by the time, you call at 8:50. You're put on hold and you kind of have to wait and kind of get lucky and see if you can make an appointment in the counseling center. So it is a pretty difficult process, unfortunately.
We're speaking with U of I sophomore Devin Dion. He's in studio in Urbana. He's vice president of Active Minds UIUC. We're going to be finding out a little bit more about what you do, Devin, in a minute. But sure. I wanted to ask, David DeBoer is also with us. He's a psychologist. He's the director of the Counseling Wellness Center at Loyola. Different, obviously, school than University of Illinois. Do you have the same level of demand that Devin's talking about?
Like my counterparts at most of the colleges and universities across the country, we see a very high demand. The demand here, as elsewhere, has been increasing, and the national average for of students who see counselors over the course of a given year is anywhere but from 7 to 10%. And we're happy to say that we see over 10% of our students who reach out for help, and we're able to connect them to the care that they need.
Would you say you think there's a shortage of traditional counseling offices of options for students across all college campuses, not just Deloitte? Or
I
don't know what
that.
You think. Okay.
I would say that campuses are doing just a great deal of things, both in terms of traditional individual counseling as well as group therapies. Here at Loyola, we also have a care manager to help students who need more intensive care get connected to longer-term care in the community. We offer online self-care apps. For students, we have a therapy dog program where a counselor goes out into the student union and library to interact with students with our therapy dog. We offer after-hours response to student residence hall and staff for students experiencing crisis after hours. And we support peer groups like Active Minds on our campus, as well as a peer health educator program. So I think colleges are doing just many, many creative things to meet the changing needs of students. But certainly the demand has increased in the last 10 years for sure.
And how do peer groups like Active Minds at Loyola help?
Well, I think, you know, one of the reasons that counseling centers across the country have seen such a rise in usage, as well as a rise in students seeking more urgent care appointments, is exactly because there's been a shift in attitude. And I think student-led groups, such as the one Devin leads, play a crucial part. Peers at this age look very much to each other for reference points, and when they're seeing messages from peers that seeking care is helpful, I think that does a lot, goes a long way to begin to change the attitudes that used to keep people who were distressed from reaching out and seeking help.
Devin,
great.
Helping for changing that. Devin, do you feel like there's still a stigma on the U of I campus? I imagine it's probably reflects what we see in general society, which is there are still stigmas attached to people who seek mental health.
Yes, I do believe that there is still a stigma on just about every college campus. And I think one of the things that contributes to the stigma is maybe not, you know, thinking negatively about mental illness, but the lack of conversation, you know, in general. And that leads to, you know, a lot of people being ignorant about the issues of mental health on campus, you know, because like 80% of kids, of college kids, you know, felt overwhelmed to the point in which they couldn't even function. And so that's kind of just become an accepted thing now, where it's just like, you know, you have a test, you stay up till 4 a.m, you're like, haha, I got no sleep last night, and then people kind of just brush that off as if it was nothing. But in reality, that's, you know, practicing poor mental health. And the fact that not a whole lot of people are talking about it, you know, puts people in this kind of shell where it's like, oh, if nobody's talking about it, or if people are talking about it in a negative manner, then, you know, maybe I shouldn't talk about it at all. You know what I mean?
Right. So what kind of things do you do at Active Minds on the U of I campus to change those conversations?
Yeah, so Active Minds here at the UIUC campus, we're actually a relatively new club, and we've just experienced a lot of growth lately. I remember on Quad Day, we got a bunch of signatures. We're really excited for our meetings. And so we try to create this, you know, close, this like almost kind of knit family. You know, we're going to do lots of things together. We have general body meetings. We're at our general body meetings, we'll usually have, you know, like an open discussion about mental health. You know, we might look at something in the news and say, hey, you know, let's talk about this. I know that there was just a recent, unfortunately, there was a shooting just recently in Jacksonville.
Mm-hmm, this past weekend.
Yeah. And so one of the articles that just came out was just that the shooter had, you know, a history of mental illness. And so I remember I see like all these shootings and they come out with mental illness articles, and it kind of puts this negative label on mental illness. And so we'll go through those, we'll talk about those and see what we can do, how we can help people, you know, interpret the media in their own way, you know, practicing.
Right, and also people just say mental illness as if, like, that could mean anything, right?
Exactly.
And that's sort of the label that's applied to this.
Yeah, and I guess one of the things that we're trying to do is, you know, help define, you know, what it is and help. One of the big things that we're trying to do is help students, you know, help students locate resources that there are on campus. Dr. Overt Loyola University, you know, he was telling us about a lot of the different programs that they have, and we have a lot of the same programs. It's just that students do not necessarily know what they are or where they are. And so what some of the things that we're trying to do as a whole is try to get, you know, here at U of I, we have workshops. You know, all freshmen have to take a sexual assault workshop, you know, a drinking and drugs workshop. But what we're trying to do is actually help get a mental health workshop and a mental illness workshop, because that's something that affects everybody on a college campus. And so for students to be aware of what's going on at the University of Illinois, then it's going to open up this conversation in which students are comfortable with talking about mental health and mental illness, and to which they can get help, because ignorance should never be the reason that someone does not get help.
Devin, if you were able to have that workshop for incoming freshmen, what would you say to them?
So I think I would inform them on the situation in the University of Illinois. I think I would try to make it, you know, the most comfortable for people to talk about mental illness and say that it's not, you know, something that's necessarily wrong with people. It's a part of life. You know, some people were born with these things, and these are real things that people have to go through. And, you know, when people make jokes about them, it really, really sets people back in their progress, I think. And, you know, having real stories from real people, you know, have students come in and talk about their, you know, struggles with mental health, and, you know, kind of create this real example, like, oh, you know, there's a sophomore speaking about mental illness. I'm a sophomore, you know, stuff like this could very well happen to me. And so, therefore, I think that, you know, having a workshop for freshmen informing people about mental illness right off the bat could really have a positive impact on the general body of students.
David DeBoer, how important is it to inform college students ahead of time about some of the difficulties that they will face?
Well, I think meeting freshmen, incoming students, transferred students and family, and letting them know all about resources and being aware of how to manage their adjustment to a new college environment and knowing what to expect is really important. We always tell families when they're here for campus interviews that if you needed care while you're at home, you'll probably need care here, and we encourage folks to set that up in advance so that they can have a kind of a continuity of care and make a more seamless transition and adjustment, because you know there's no such thing as a geographic cure, and you take your struggles with you, and so it's best to be prepared when you're transferring to a new environment.
And I wanted to ask you on that point about families. Oftentimes students, when they're starting college, are 18. I know that sometimes this is an issue, whether or not parents and families should be informed. David DeBoer, when do you all figure that out? Like, where's the line there?
Where's the line for informing
Bringing families in if they're not aware? Mm-hmm.
You know, that's really on a case-by-case basis that a counselor or therapist working with a student has to have that conversation, and certainly encourage disclosure to family members when things like the mental health issue may be impacting issues such as personal safety, and so we try to encourage dialogue whenever possible. It's not always possible, and it's not always in a student's best interest either, so it's really a very case-by-case basis.
Devin, we have less than a minute left. I just wanted to ask you what final advice you have for college students, people who have college students in their lives, about how they can be helped to have good mental health.
Open up the conversation about mental health. I cannot stress that enough. There are going to be a lot of kids in college, you know, who go through many stressful things, and it's okay to talk about stuff like that. There are resources for you on campus. There are people who are advocating for you on campus. You know, like me, I go to a big school of 44,000 kids, but there are people in that big ocean of fish. You know, there are people who are just like you, and it's up to you to go and find them. We're here for you.
That's Devin Dion, a student at the University of Illinois and vice president of Active Minds UIUC. You also heard from David DeBoer, a psychologist and director of Loyola Chicago's Counseling Wellness Center. I spoke with both of them last August. Coming up after the break, food writer Louisa Chu spent a whole month eating and writing about the best foods of the Midwest. Have you planned your summer cookout for today yet? You'll want to stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope you're having a safe and relaxing Memorial Day weekend. Maybe you're getting ready to fire up that grill. Summer is hopefully on the way soon. With that warmer weather comes all kinds of great seasonal foods. I'm thinking about corn, cherries, frozen custard. Then, of course, there's the ice-cold beer. It just so happens all of those food treats are ones we can claim in the Midwest. But what do we mean when we say Midwest food? And why? The produce makes sense. It's what grows well here. But why is a horseshoe an Illinois sandwich, and who makes it the best? Last August, we sat down with Chicago Tribune food writer Louisa Chu. She spent an entire month searching for, eating, and writing about Midwest food. We were with her at Northwestern University in Evanston, and I started by asking her why she spent a whole month exploring Midwestern food.
At the Tribune, every month we have a theme, and so this month we decided to do Midwestern food because, of course, you know, being in Chicago, we are the heart of the Midwest, some might say, others might argue, and because
we can say that.
Right.
Let's see.
There we
go. If you have an argument with that, you can call too and tell us that.
We like to say the greater Middle West, at least I do, and we're at the height of our, you know, peak produce season, and so, yeah, of course, corn on the cob, soybeans even, are, you know, all terrific. Tomatoes. I mean, who doesn't love?
Well, I brought peaches
tomatoes
up from Southern Illinois.
What?
To Chicago. Yeah, they're over there. Maybe I'll share some with you later.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Absolutely. And so, you know, and especially because we do see so much sort of coming into season right now, and we want to see not only what's going on in the farmers markets, but, you know, in chef's tables, and kind of like some of the old fashioned things too. Like I had a chance to go and visit the Lake County Fair because there's so many county fairs, you know, throughout the Midwest. And it seems like we're all kind of known for, actually, did you know that elephant ears are more of a Midwestern thing than funnel cakes?
I didn't know that, yeah. But elephant ears are my preferred
fair
food. We had it at the state fair two mm-hmm. weeks ago. We had elephant ears. We had apple on elephant ears, which I like, just the traditional one.
Me too.
So is there a definition of quote-unquote Midwestern food?
There has been some very iconic Midwestern foods. Not surprisingly, more European-based. I mean, there are certainly in, you know, Illinois, as you mentioned, the horseshoe, which for people who have not had the pleasure.
Oh, explain what a horseshoe
right,
is.
Right, exactly. You know, it's kind of, I think the story behind it goes that it may be like a northern United Kingdom kind of inspired, you know, Welsh rarebit, fries and cheese and gravy, and then a hamburger patties in there and toast, you know, and it's
or
all
any kind of open-faced meat.
Right, yes, you
right.
got the meats. Yes, exactly.
So open-faced meat with cheese, gravy, and fries.
Mm-hmm. Those are the essential.
That's the essential
Trinity.
Part of a horseshoe.
Right. And so there's, you know, that's kind of one of the classic Midwestern foods. But now, you know, even for corn on the cob, for example, when I went to the Lake County Fair, I almost went and had a classic butter dipped ear of corn on the cob. Wonderful, terrific, can't get any better. But then I heard somebody was doing like a secret off the menu elote. And that now you
remind us what elote.
So elote is originally a Mexican street food corn, and it's typically then you know, roasted ear on the corn on the cob, slathered with parquet margarine and mayonnaise, then with some lime chili powder and some cotija cheese or other like sort of white dry crumbled cheese, and then you can have some certain other variations too, like hot sauce, like tahini, you know, like sort of sweet savory. So, you know, the definition of what Midwestern food is really changing too, as our immigration patterns change and the face of the Midwest changes too.
Right, which is always what we see with our food, right?
Yep.
Let's go to Tony from Champaign. Hi, Tony. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, telling your screener, I travel throughout the Midwest a lot with a group of people, and we like to dine out. And we often ask what they're known for at places. I mean, you know, things that you don't even think of, but they're
like
known
what?
For. Like Cincinnati. I don't know if you've ever heard of Geta.
No. Mm-hmm. Louisa, have you heard of that?
I'm not sure I know that. What
is that, Tony?
I was thinking you were going to say the chili.
Beef and pork and oats, steel-cut oats. They make it into a loaf, bake it, and then grill it. And it's really interesting, really, really good. I've made it at home. Then Kentucky, you have your burgoo, the hot browns down in Louisville.
Yeah,
well, I would think when you said Cincinnati, I thought you were going to say Skyline Chili on spaghetti.
No, that's what everybody goes for.
Well, Tony, thank you. That was great.
Yeah, just ask when you go out, and you know, they like to tell you about their stories about their food.
People definitely love to tell you their stories about food. And we actually have two folks here I want to introduce who have food stories that they are sharing with all of the Chicago community. Tim and Rebecca Graham are also here in studio with us in Evanston. They recently opened the restaurant Twain in Chicago in Logan Square. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thank you. We're happy to be here.
Absolutely.
So, Tim, you're the chef. Rebecca, you're the sommelier and beverage director. And we wanted to talk to you because Louisa wrote about the restaurant for the Tribune, highlighting your Midwestern inspirations. What does it mean for you guys that Twain you call Twain a Midwest-inspired restaurant?
I think for us, it really is centered around everywhere the Mississippi River kind of touches, or just the bandwidth around that of the Mississippi River, but also just those culinary traditions of like grandma's house and casseroles and the aunt coming over and just family gatherings is sort of one of the major inspirations for the restaurant, as well as the spiral bound books of like Episcopal churches.
I was going to say it's church cookbooks.
Yeah,
they're
a lot of them
are
church related. Many of them are, you know, auxiliary women's club related, all generally done for a fundraising sort of effort for a charity. And we at our house probably have dang near 300 of them, and brought some fun ones if we get a chance to look at those. So
yeah,
hey, watch that language, dang.
Rebecca, what does it mean for you? I mean, when we think about, I do think it's kind of in a way we don't really have a good definition of even Midwest. I think sometimes that can even be something people argue about. But what does it mean for you all for the restaurant to be Midwest inspired?
Well, the restaurant really comes from Tim's heart, and a lot of his heart belongs to his Missouri upbringing. And Tim and I have defined the restaurant as, you know, taking inspiration from the places, of course, that surround the Mississippi River that flows across the country. But really, a lot of the food that we're touching on, that's something that's so interesting, is that you really get it everywhere. You know, we have chicken and dumplings on our menu, and that's my favorite dish on the menu right now. I had chicken and dumplings as a little girl growing up west of the Rockies. I think everybody can touch that dish, and there's so many different ways that, you know, it can be made. We've found, you know, at least four or five different styles of chicken and dumplings from north to south and east to west. Mm. And ours is particular to the way that they make it here.
When you say here, Tim, do you mean Missouri, or what is a Missouri chicken and dumplings? How is that different?
At least my Missouri is my own experience, and I didn't know that I grew up in the South till I moved to Chicago. I'm like, I'm not Southern, and that starts in Arkansas.
I felt that way about Miami.
I was like, what? I am? And our traditional one would have a Bisquick drop kind of dumpling that gets simmered inside of it, and then the baking powder activates and makes it all nice and fluffy.
Mm.
There are other sort of torn noodle versions and even some saltine as place of dumpling versions out there. But ours, certainly growing up in my neck of the woods, at least with my family, was a drop biscuit kind of dumpling.
And are most of the recipes at your restaurant, are they inspired or from family recipes? Or these cookbooks that you guys were talking about?
Very much inspired, at least by one of them comes directly from these cookbooks. Not often is the recipe translatable to the restaurant stage when these were produced by sort of amateur cooks in some way for a much different venue, for a family dining room table than a restaurant table. But the crust on our mushroom turnovers is, when I made it straight out of the book, I was like, well, that doesn't need changing. And it's an interesting one. It's cream cheese, butter, and flour.
Mm,
mostly
right.
Cream cheese. And mm-hmm. It's just flaky and has that acid.
And probably really easy to work with, right, with the cream cheese.
It is really easy to work with, unless the kitchen's a little too hot. Then it's like Salvador Dali clocks. Like, you got to go in and out of the cooler, in and out of the cooler. So
we're talking Midwestern food. I know you guys brought some with Tim Graham. He's the chef at Twain, just opened in Chicago's Logan Square neighborhood. His wife, Rebecca, is the beverage director. We're going to talk about cocktails in a minute. Louisa Chu's also with us. You're welcome to join our conversation and chime in with your favorite Midwestern food. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. We've been collecting your comments on social media. Tim, to your point, we had someone comment on Facebook about green bean casserole and jokingly saying that anything Midwestern is making it unhealthy, taking vegetables and putting, I think that's a American, I don't think that's a Midwestern trait. I think that's all over this country, right?
There's a lot of cans of cream of mushroom soup found in all of these books here. But I think there's some level of, like, when the French Nouveau moved away from those super cream sauces, there's some of that going on with the Midwestern foods right now. That's just not how we eat, you know. And if we make a porcini cream, it might have half and half instead of double cream, just reduced and reduced. Mm-hmm. I think an interesting, almost micro-familial variation on the green bean casserole is really the question is, what's your topping? You know, are you a French's onion family? Are you a cornflake family? Are you a crushed up saltine
family? Oh, I didn't know there were cornflake families. I didn't even know that existed.
Our cornflake is for the cheesy potato casserole.
Right, correct.
Family,
that is where it's supposed to be. Oh, that's interesting.
That sounds like a mixed marriage there. Boy, cornflake.
So what food did you bring? You brought some stuff for us to taste here.
Yeah, we brought our little flower pot. So crudité is a big part of all the sort of party gatherings, those cocktail hours. You'd have a, even now you buy it in Jewel in the plastic shell casing and just eat it off of that. Our crudité today is provided by Nichols Farm and Orchard. All the vegetables are from them. And
where is Nichols Farm? In
Indiana somewhere?
No, Nichols is actually in Illinois.
Okay.
I believe towards in the direction of Wisconsin.
Okay.
So.
Sorry, Nick. we serve ours on crushed ice in a flower pot with three
this
dips.
This is so great. And, I feel like it's so pretty, and now I'm going to mess it up by having something to eat. And what are the dips?
So we have Green Goddess, aioli, and ranch.
Okay, these are going to be very crunchy. Which one do you think I should try first?
The aioli is aioli. The dish is inspired by a French dish called Le Grand Aioli, which is just a wonderful way to eat lunch.
No, this is so great. I shouldn't talk while I'm eating.
How would we know otherwise?
How do you think the dip, so do you feel like this is kind of a classic Midwestern situation, Tim?
Definitely vegetables and dips. My generation, it was all about the Hidden Valley Ranch. I think the aioli is just much more finessed and yummier, perhaps, than the Hidden Valley Ranch.
So this is your ranch. I'm not double dipping.
That's our house-made ranch. Quite a bit of dill in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then our Green Goddess. Green Goddess
is
one of
the dill's bright.
Yeah, it's really bright. Green Goddess is one of those American recipes that comes down from a very specific place, and it comes from an old play that was being, I guess, staged on the West Coast in San Francisco. And like so many great food names, the lead lady was quite the heartbreaker, and the maitre d' of the hotel where she was staying was smitten and made this dressing for her. And
what is in Green Goddess? Are we allowed to tell me what's in Green Goddess dressing?
Ours is sour cream, mayonnaise, vinegar, and then tons of herbs that we puree. Basil, tarragon.
I can taste the herbs, like the tarragon is really coming out. Mm.
It's kind of an herby, creamy dressing, really, Green Goddess.
We're talking about Midwestern food. I know we've got a couple callers. Let's try to get to one before we go to the break. Let's go to Helen from Lincoln. Hi, Helen. Welcome to the 21st.
Good morning.
What is your favorite Midwestern food?
We like the fried pumpkin blossoms.
Fried pumpkin blossoms.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's like zucchini blossoms?
Yeah. I have used the zucchini. I've used the banana squash, but we usually, grow pumpkins, so we have that.
Mm. And then do you stuff them with anything?
What I do is I dip them in an egg milk mixture and then dip them in a crush cracker. Mm. And I usually use the butter flavor crackers. And then I lightly brown them in oil. And then I put a little sliver of cream cheese and stack them. And They're delicious.
Wow. Everybody here, you've got lots of people wishing they could eat that right now based on the faces. And thanks, Ellen. Thanks for that. I appreciate
You're very welcome.
I know we've got a couple other calls. If you want to keep calling, we're going to continue this conversation after the break. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. We've just got a minute before the break, but Rebecca, I wanted to ask you about drinks. Are there, do you think, quintessential Midwestern cocktails?
There certainly are. A lot of them are things that we've heard about. The Wisconsin style old fashioned, for instance, is sort of a classic in the in certain circles. As far as the spiral bound cookbooks go, there is a moment in time where it became acceptable to include alcohol in your
recipes.
Yeah,
I didn't realize those were in there.
Yeah,
okay.
So a lot of the punch recipes and the entertaining recipes go back all the way, you know, to the earliest books that we have, don't include alcohol until about 1970.
That's Rebecca Graham, beverage director and sommelier at Twain in Chicago. You are also hearing Tim Graham, who's the chef at Twain, and Louisa Chu, a food writer with the Chicago Tribune. I sat down with all three of them back in August of last year to talk about the best Midwestern foods. We're revisiting my conversation with them today on this Memorial Day. Stay with us. We'll continue this special just after the short break. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're just tuning in, we're revisiting one of our favorite conversations on this Memorial Day. Back in August, we celebrated some of the most amazing food we have right here in the Midwest, whether it's the old standbys like Chicago hot dogs, St. Louis ribs, Wisconsin cheese curds, or maybe even the hidden gems in your community. I spoke with Louisa Chu, food writer at the Chicago Tribune and host of the Chewing Podcast, along with Tim and Rebecca Graham from Twain in Chicago. Tim's the chef, Rebecca's the beverage director and sommelier. We also heard from a lot of you. So let's hear the rest of that conversation, starting actually with a caller. Here's Joe from Champaign.
To me, you can't talk Midwestern food without talking about the proverbial kidney bean salad.
Yeah, you've got fist pumps in the studio here, Joe.
I moved away from here for a little bit and out in the West Coast, and half the people, or more than half, had never heard of it, had never seen it, and looked at me like I was crazy when I said you take kidney beans and mayonnaise.
Oh, and mayonnaise!
In my household, it was kidney beans and a Miracle Whip. You couldn't use mayonnaise because you had to have the sweetness of the Miracle
the
Whip.
Sweetness. Oh, that's interesting. Thanks for that one, Joe. Kidney bean salad with mayonnaise? That's not the kidney bean salad I know. That's interesting, Tim.
Yeah, what dressing are you thinking of when you see
No it? Dressing at all. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of kidney beans and green beans and onions. Mm-hmm. And all kind of mixed up, but there's not a dressing with it.
We have a dish on our menu that features another word for this kidney bean salad that you see, or this multi-bean salad, is calico salad.
And so that's different than what Joe was talking about.
The dressing that most often comes with the calico salad is more of just vinegar, sugar, that sort of sweet
Okay, so it's different than what Joe was talking about. I wanted to go back to our caller from Lincoln who mentioned fried pumpkin blossoms. Mm-hmm. Louisa, we would be remiss if we did not talk about pumpkin in the state of Illinois when we're talking about food.
Well, Helen must know that Illinois is the pumpkin capital of the world. Actually, I think the U.S. I'm not sure about the world. And right now,
North America.
There we go. And so right now is when we're seeing the blossoms coming out. Of course, people are most familiar with the zucchini, which are really famous in Italian culture. But here again, in the Midwest, you know, we use what we had. The immigrants who came over planted a lot of squash and a lot of pumpkins. And then when those are blossoming right now, before the big pumpkins come fully ripe in the fall for Halloween, is when there's so many blossoms. I have a neighbor down the street in my Chicago bungalow neighborhood who grows vines that go like way out to the sidewalk. And I'm always kind of looking out for the blossoms. And I ask her if I can eat them. And she's like, what? And I'm like, yeah, no, they're totally delicious, you know? And so I've got to try them with a little bit of those like saltine cracker crust. That sounds delicious.
Louisa, you said immigrants planted them. What wave of immigrants? Are these Eastern European immigrants? Like when did we start doing that? And I imagine there would have been squash that would have been native here, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I'm sure there were, but I'm not sure how they were used. But certainly a lot of the Italian immigrants that were
growing.
Especially in the western part of the Chicago area, where now we're seeing that, which was kind of really the agricultural heart of the city area around, you know, and so now we're seeing a lot of those blossoms that are just seasonal on menus, as well as a really unique item that is coming up here called Melrose Peppers, which is actually named after Melrose Park, a suburb just west of Chicago. So I love that cream cheese. That's different than the ricotta and goat cheese that I've seen in Italian menus.
Mm. So let's talk about some other food that you saw. Louisa, broasted chicken, which yes. I was having to explain to people. I had really good broasted chicken actually in Arthur, Illinois, which you know is like a very large Amish community. Mm-hmm. And that's the first time I'd ever had broasted chicken. It was so good. Mm-hmm. Can you explain?
Yeah. So we all have seen, I should say, most of us who have been lucky enough to see broasted on menus, you know, as we're eating this, what seems like fried chicken.
If you see broast on a menu, you should do it.
You should totally do it. And you think, come on, what is this? Is this even a real word? It turns out that the Broaster Company was created in Beloit, Wisconsin, by an inventor named L.A.M. Phelan back in the 50s. And he came up with not only the pressure fryer, which is called the Broaster, but a coating called the slow broaster coating and the chickite marinator. I might be getting them. Yeah.
Oh,
confused.
So I thought broasting just meant, I didn't even know how you broasted it.
In order to be genuine broasted chicken, you have to have the three-step process, which is the coating, the marinade, the coating, and the pressure fryer. But here's the fascinating thing that I learned is that the Broaster Company, while it was invented here in the Midwest, has gone out into the world and is now almost synonymous with fried chicken in Pakistan and India. And in fact,
interesting,
there is a genuine broaster chain that is hugely popular in India and now
that we have exported to there.
Yes, and it's become embraced, and now they're currently having, if you look on their Facebook page, a special for Mint Lovers Pizza and their spicy broasted chicken. So it's kind of fascinating how this Midwestern food kind of goes out in the world and comes back. And I discovered actually that quite a few of the Pakistani restaurants that are, again, just west of the city here are doing genuine broasted chicken or
but
chicken
not
broast.
For example, like on Devon, like at Khan Barbecue. Are they doing both?
Some restaurants, okay, which will go unnamed by me,
okay,
will have
oops,
broasted chicken or chicken broast on their menu. It's not the official broaster chicken, which has to have the three-step process.
Okay.
Yeah. But
so you should ask, is there a three-step process involved in this chicken? If not, it's not broasted.
Not necessarily. I mean, which is fascinating because it's become, you know, like it's a genericized usage, like we think about Kleenex. You know, so it's become almost synonymous with fried chicken. But in order to have genuine broasted chicken, you need that slow bro and that chickite. And that becomes broasted chicken. But it's fascinating because there actually is a spicy broasted chicken coating now too, which you can get at a restaurant called Millie Supper Club, which is a Wisconsin-inspired restaurant where they do actually have that calico style three bean salad on their like fancy relish tray called the Lazy Susan. So it's pretty fascinating how that goes out there in the world and then comes back sort of transformed.
We're talking Midwestern food with the Chicago Tribune's Louisa Chu. Tim and Rebecca Graham are also in studio with us, and we're taking your calls. 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. We have a couple minutes left if you want to join us. Let's go to Chris in Decatur. Hey, Chris, do you want to go back to our horseshoe conversation? I understand.
Yeah, I didn't really hear you guys talk about it too much. I mean, I've been in and out of radio, but I mean, yeah. In Decatur, we have a hamburger horseshoe. I believe they have it in Springfield, and it's the most disgusting thing to describe.
What?
And the most disgusting thing to look at. But it's the best thing to eat in Central Illinois.
I was waiting for that last part there. I do think an interesting. I didn't know that there were horseshoes. Are there a couple? Like, do you find horseshoes on the menu in a couple places in Decatur, Chris?
Oh, you can find them almost everywhere. Even at Steak and Shake, you can ask them for one, and they'll make you one.
Wow. Oh, interesting. Thanks for that, Chris. Mm. I have, you know, you don't really see, I think I've seen horseshoes on the one menu in Champaign, in the Champaign-Urbana area. It sounds like they're in Decatur, obviously in Springfield. Mm. Louisa, we were talking about the history of the horseshoe before. Mm. That, I mean, horseshoes have been around for a long time.
Mm-hmm. I actually am not the horseshoe expert at the Tribune. My colleague, Nick Kindlesberger, actually did a little road trip, I think a little bit earlier this year, and went on a bit of a horseshoe quest. He also wrote a story about the Cincinnati chili. And I'm sure that whatever we say, that there are going to be disputed histories. I don't know if you guys have seen Rebecca and Tim in your cookbooks, any sort of
have you in the cookbooks, have you history. Seen any? I did want to ask you all about in the cookbooks, and Louisa, I want to ask you about this, about sort of the idea of different meat sandwiches, because that seems to be a very, like, whether we're talking about Italian beef or other things. Tim, do you guys have anything like that on your menu? Like a meat sandwich?
Besides our hamburger, we don't really have a meat sandwich. But the Sloppy Joe is reimagined on top of a roasted bone marrow. On top of some of the, so the sandwich is referenced. It's just not sandwiched.
Right. So my understanding is there is kind of that piled meat. Someone actually, we had a Facebook message, a Facebook mention of this, of a meat sandwich. It's sort of like a, but it's like a Sloppy Joe, but with meat instead of a ground beef.
It is loose meat, so which sounds so unpleasant.
So right? Loose meat, yes. Right. That was what we had a mention on Facebook of, loose meat.
So loose meat sandwich is eventually kind of the milder cousin of the Sloppy Joe. But I also wanted to mention, so it is, again, basically just sort of like, you know, crumbled ground beef, and it is served gently spiced and sauced.
Oh, so it is ground beef.
Yes, typically it is ground beef, and in a bun, and so it's kind of like a little difficult to manage. I also wanted to mention, actually, during our Midwestern month, one of the sandwiches that I had a chance to try and write about, which is called the Steak Sweet or the Sweet Steak, which is somewhat like a...
Did you say sweet steak?
Yes, Steak Sweet or Sweet Steak, which is a Southside Chicago specialty, which has all the flavors of a really delicious vintage Sloppy Joe, but apparently it was inspired about 50 so years ago by a Philly cheesesteak, but has really now become a Chicago original and has kind of gone from the South Side of Chicago across the African-American community. So if you talk to certain people, their mouths will water. Now my mouth is going to start to
water. I mean, all of this.
I know.
We've got one last caller that I want to try to get to, Brian from Chenoa. Hey, Brian, welcome to the 21st.
Well, thank you, and you're making me hungry right before lunch.
So. It's right before lunch, so it's a good time.
Yes. But
Brian, I understand you're calling us from... Yeah, I understand you're calling us from sitting on your tractor. Is that correct?
Yes, and I just shut it off, and I'm going to tell you, you've missed one thing, and it's my favorite thing of the summer, and it's sweet corn. And
how do you prepare it, right?
Oh, we can do it anyway. You can boil it, but we've done it in the microwave. We've done it on the grill, but I don't care. It's all good.
It is. Thank you for that. And I really enjoyed, actually, at the Illinois State Fair, this fresh sweet corn, which was, you know, really, which was great. Obviously, it's always great when you're barbecuing corn, but when you know that it's that fresh corn. Urbana had its sweet corn festival last week. Let's end by talking about some sweets. Tim, you brought a dessert for us here.
Yep, gooey butter cake, which is an awesome, rich dessert. Really, really localized to the St. Louis region. I think it makes its way to Alton a little bit, but you just don't see it anywhere else out of there. And our pastry chef, Stephanie Bishop, she's really hit it out of the park. It's traditionally a box of yellow cake mix, which is then enriched with more melted
it's
butter.
It's like the original cake mix.
Out of the box. It's enriched with... quite a bit of melted butter, some eggs, and more vanilla.
I'm going to ruin... Sorry, we didn't take a picture of this before I eat it.
Oh, we got some pictures.
Oh, you did? Yes. Okay, great. And is this... Was that fruit?
Yeah, those are rosemary roasted peaches.
Wow.
And then a cream cheese, powdered sugar, and egg layer is poured over the cake batter. And they kind of bake and join together into this amalgam that's a custardy and soft.
And then you have a crunch. Are these peanuts?
Those are Marcona almonds.
So good.
Now, Tim, I hear that the cream cheese addition is a bit controversial in the St. Louis world. You being a native Missourian, is that the correct pronunciation?
Yes, ma'am. There are two types of one is more of a sugar pie, sugar cake kind of thing without the cream cheese. I think the iconic ones that I was exposed to early were all the cream cheese version.
Interesting.
You're a lot younger too.
Lisa, you looked at some other desserts as well. Buttermilk raspberry bar?
So that actually is from a new shop called Pretty Cool Ice Cream. And it is from a pastry chef named Dana Cree, who worked with Rebecca. Did you guys work together at the Publican?
We never worked together directly.
Okay.
But I've known Dana for a long time and really admired everything she was doing at the bakery and at Blackbird.
So they are now doing sort of fancier versions of popsicles, everything on a stick, frozen treats on a stick. And so,
which is just like what you get at every state fair.
Exactly. And so the buttermilk bar is using like really great quality buttermilk and local fruit. And I love the fact that when I asked her what was her favorite flavor, she's got like 50 flavors right now. Right away, she had said actually the black raspberry bar. So I'd mentioned the raspberry, I think, that was in the picture online. And but yeah, they're just really delicious. I mean, simple and just wonderful.
That was Louisa Chew, food writer at the Chicago Tribune and host of the Chewing podcast. She spent an entire month eating and writing about the best foods in our part of the country. You also heard from Tim Graham and Rebecca Graham from the restaurant Twain in Chicago. Tim's a chef. Rebecca's the beverage director and sommelier. We spoke last summer at Northwestern University in Evanston. That's all the time we have for today. I hope you've enjoyed your Memorial Day weekend so far. Tomorrow we'll be back live in our Urbana studios. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis, background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. We were also on Facebook if you want to search for the 21st to like us. That's another way to comment, interact with us, post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us, all you have to remember is our website. That's 21stshow.org. That's also where we've got all of our past shows archived. And we're also available, by the way, most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify, NPR One, iTunes. Search for The 21st. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Eunice Alpison is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.